3 weeks ago, on day one of our Ontario fishing trip, my son-in-law, RJ, was on hyperdrive. It was his first time to fish in Canada, and over the previous months, I had, I guess you could say, stoked his imagination with all of these wonderful stories and passing along magazine articles about the trophy smallmouth bass fishing on Rainy Lake. I said to him, "You have never seen smallmouths as big as the ones you're going to catch. I guarantee it." And fortunately, the fish obliged. When RJ hooked into his first bona fide trophy, he went bonkers. "This fish is huge! It's huge! Get the net! Get the net!" And meanwhile, I'm in the other end of the boat, moving, because I knew what was happening here. I knew this was going to take a while. "Get the net! Hurry up! I'm going to lose him!" So, got the net, and scooped him up, put him on the floor of the boat, and his hand is shaking like this as he's picking up this fish, and I look at it somewhat admiringly, snap a couple of pictures, and I said, "Decent fish." He said, "What do you mean, decent? This thing's a pig." I said, "I mean that I'm going to catch a lot of them much bigger than this week." And I did. And so did he. It was a teaching moment as a wise, grizzled fisherman passed along some fishing wisdom to the younger generation. And I said, "RJ, don't be in such a rush. Turn off all of the adrenaline. Play the fish. When it zips this way, turn your rod that way. When it goes this way, roll your rod that way. Savor the experience. Slow down, RJ. Slow down." And he did the rest of the week, and had a much more enjoyable experience than doing it in that frenzied state with which he began. And as I thought about this, I realized that this is also good advice when it comes to caring for our souls. Becoming a wise and deep and spiritual person cannot be rushed. Adrenaline is not a part of the equation, because it is only by slowing down and focusing and listening that we can know the fruits of a relationship with God. Our daughter Stephanie came from the womb, popped out at 75 miles an hour, and has been on cruise control ever since. It has served her well. She is now the partner in a big accounting firm in South Bend, and she has a very demanding job, which means she's usually taking planes every week either to Florida or to Arizona to conduct audits. And for Stephanie and Bill and their three kids, every day must run according to a precise schedule. At the back door is this good-sized whiteboard that has the days of the week, and below each one, the hour-by-hour schedule of the whole Cerny family. Because getting everyone where they need to be on time, and then on to the next place, and the next place after that, until at last everyone is together at the end of the day, is a logistical nightmare. Without that whiteboard, one of them might be left behind, or lost, or maybe even forgotten, because every day is go, go, and go some more. And soon I can be around that for a while before we start to go nuts. I don't know, maybe we were like that 40 years ago, perhaps. But, you know, we live in this fast, frenzied, frayed, and frazzled culture. We scurry around like frantic ants trying to get the last morsels of food for winter. But you cannot savor anything going 75 miles an hour. Fast, quick, and instant isn't the language of listening, praying, and getting in touch with the soul. There are no fast tracks, and there are no shortcuts to God. Spiritual growth takes a lifetime. And we who are so accustomed to getting everything right now don't like to hear that. We don't have a lifetime to learn this, but that's all you've got. It takes a lifetime to become a spiritual person. There are growing pains along the way, but there is also so much more to be gained if we simply learn what it means to slow down, to be still. And as the scripture says, know that God is God. In last Sunday's lesson from Hebrews 11, we talked about faith and said that faith is the invisible means of God's support. As that scripture says, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Nothing now or nothing to come will ever be able to pull us from that grip of God's love and grace. And this morning, the lesson from Hebrews tells us that the walk of faith does not come quickly. It is not easy. It is not straight, nor is it well marked. There are obstacles to negotiate. The grade is sometimes very steep. There are no bypasses. You cannot rush. It is not for the frantic nor faint of heart. Walking by faith, day by day, takes patience and perseverance. There was a canoe outfitter somewhere out in California where the city people came for a vacation, and a lot of them liked to get into the canoes and travel this gorgeous scenic river. And the problem was, these folks were finishing the trip in 2 hours when it should have taken them at least 5 hours to do it. He said they didn't know how to slow down. And so for every person who was going on that trip, they first of all had to put on a t-shirt. It said this, going slow is essential to the journey. Otherwise, there is so much that we miss. The writer of Hebrews says that by faith Israel passed through the Red Sea towards the Promised Land. By faith the Jericho walls tumbled. The writer says, time would fail me to tell of all the others, Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and all the prophets. And by faith, it says, they inherited the promise that was given to Abraham. Now that promise is a really big deal, because throughout the Old Testament, that promise is referred to. Because there were times many years after God gave that promise to Abraham of a new land and descendants more numerous than the stars, there was a time when they lost track of that promise. Many of them did not fare very well. As it says, they were tortured and mocked and flogged and put in chains, stoned to death, sawn in two, impaled, persecuted, tormented. They wandered through deserts and mountains. They had to be clothed in animal skins. They hid in holes and in caves. It would be a long and slow journey. And yet, they remained faithful to the God who was faithful to them. You see, Moses and Abraham and those that went in those generations before did not receive the promise. They did not get to inherit, see the promised land. They were headed somewhere and they didn't make it. It was yet to come. And yet there was something in even that that gave them faith that even though they weren't going to arrive, even though they would not see it in their lifetimes, and it enabled them to see things more clearly in the present. Though the promise was yet to be filled, there were all kinds of evidences of how God was providing in the moment. They began to do something which is so hard for us. They began to trust in what they could not see beyond their prayers. They were steadfast, not because they were strong and able and believed in the Americans' exceptionalism. No, they won strength out of their weakness. It was slow going. There was much to endure, but it helped them see the signs of God's provision all around them. Any of you have any of the books that were written by Robert Fulghum? One of my favorite fun authors. In his book, he tells the story of a neighbor who he said was the most time-bound person he had ever met. He was always in a rush. He was always harassed and fuzzed out. He was a very successful businessman. His new car was a Range Rover, one of those British vehicles designed for high adventure to take you through canyons and up to mountaintops and through savannas and across deserts and in blizzards. Although he mostly drove it to face the dangers of the underground parking ramps at the First National Bank. He rushed from the house every morning with a cup of coffee, a gym bag, a golf bag, his raincoat, an umbrella, and a briefcase. And the briefcase was a doozy. It was made of the purest, unblemished belting leather. The hardware was solid brass. It had the combination lock. His name was embroidered in gold. And when the thing was full, it weighed probably 20 pounds. It was 7 a.m. one morning, and Fulghum and his neighbor lady greeted one another as they were on the way to work. She was a social worker at an Episcopal church and drove what Fulghum calls an 8-year-old Ford, just get me to work and back, please God, sedan. While he was driving a 1952 GMC 2-ton go-ahead and hit-me panel truck. And as they were talking, Mr. Range Rover comes rushing out of the house, and they wave to him, and he had barely enough time to acknowledge them. He didn't have time for small talk because time was money, and he loaded all of his stuff into his lorry, jumped in the car, belted himself in the driver's seat, and cranked the engine, and off he went. Not realizing that beautiful briefcase and coffee cup were still on the roof and remained there as he pulled away. So the Episcopal social worker immediately jumped into her old Ford and began to chase him. She was on his bumper, honking and honking the horn, but he wasn't hearing it because he was on his cell phone talking to London. And when he was done with the phone call, he began to get irritated by the sounds that were coming from behind him. That incessant honking finally got the best of him. He threw his cell phone on the floor. He rolled down the window, leaned out, and displayed a prominent finger on his left hand to this, "I'm trying to tell you something important, lady." And the gesture did not faze her because she was on a mission. Now, Foljam, in his 2-ton panel truck, was right behind her. While she was honking, he was laying on the horn of something that he had salvaged from a junkyard. It did not honk as much as it went, "Aluga." And so here is this scene, the lady, honk, 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 "Aluga, aluga." And finally, Mr. Range Rover slammed on the brakes, flung open the door, and tried to get out but couldn't, and he was left dangling there, held by his seat belt. The coffee cup slid off the briefcase, doink, doink, bounced on the hood, and shattered on the pavement, followed by the briefcase, which slipped off, smashed into the hood, scratched the length of it, and fell upon the shattered cup. And having accomplished her mission, the social worker drove carefully around the scene of the accident. She smiled and she waved and said, "Have a nice day." Well, the poor man was dangling from his car in the clutches of a seatbelt. And Foljam writes, "No, no. As you might anticipate, she did not run over his briefcase. No, she did not. I did." And listen to these words as Foljam reflects on that experience. He said, "Mr. Range Rover is not a bad guy. Like me, he sometimes takes on more than he can handle. Like me, he gets confused about what's important. I see myself in his mirror. It's less embarrassing to talk about the way he runs his life than to talk about the cartoon character of my own." I want to take a few minutes and show you a segment of a presentation that was given by a guy named Mark Iaconelli, who's a Presbyterian pastor, a guru in youth ministries, and just an all-around fascinating guy. He appeared at an annual conference a couple of years ago and shared this wonderful story, this life-changing story that came about all because of a lesson he learned from his 4-year-old son. Let's give it a watch.
The soul is that place in you that is in constant wonder. Constant wonder. While we walk by, you know, the only thing that really grabs our attention in the moment, I've noticed, is our cell phones, our text messaging machines. On the way out here, there was a guy who ran late to the plane. Everybody was on the plane. They were getting ready to close the door. This guy comes running in. He's got 2 bags. He's not going to find any overhead compartment, but he's going to check every door, of course. And he's coming down the plane, and he's going, "I can't believe I made it." And the steward is saying, you got to find a seat. All of a sudden, his phone rings. And he stops everything. The whole plane is waiting for him to sit down to get to this phone, right? And who calls you on the phone? People who are bored. People who are driving in their car. Nothing to do. "Hey, what are you doing?" And you could tell this is one of the guys who called him. He's going, "Yeah, oh, well, I'm trying to get on a plane right now." And this woman comes up and says, "Can I help you?" And he says, "Yeah." And she grabs his phone and shuts it. She says, "Go find your seat." This guy was like stunned. And everybody, just like here, applauded. Not just for him, but for all those people who have nothing to do, who call us at the wrong time. And I wish we were as attentive as we are to our phones. I wish we were as attentive to wonder, to the 10,000 miracles that we pass each day of our lives. beauty of the sky, the wonder of children, these babies who are here among us with these faces. They're so present, so fresh from God. The warmth of friendship.
But you can't bring it up.
The intimacy of family. Good food to eat. Coffee. All these things, right? And we hurry past them. But the soul's in constant wonder. My son, Joseph, when he was 4 years old, my older son was six, I was in charge of getting ready to school and taking him to school in the morning. So they would, I would get up, we'd kind of do this hustle where I'm getting their shoes on and they're taking them off and I'm putting them back on and then they're throwing them around the room and I'm trying to keep them on them, duct taping them back on the ankles and getting their backpacks ready, making the lunches. Come on, guys, ready to get ready for school. And the deal was that I would walk them to school, and then after I dropped them off at this little preschool, I would walk to work. So I had to get them there so I could get to work on time. And so I'm hurrying up, and I'm getting them going. And when we would get out the door, my older son, Noah, he's a little bit more like me. He's a little wired. And so he would start running, and I'd start running. I'd say, come on, Joseph, let's go. And my younger son, Joseph, 4 years old, would just walk like this. And I'd say, Joseph, come on, man, we got to hurry. I got to get to work. We got to get you to school. Come on, buddy. And he would walk, and as he was walking, he would always start, stop, and go, Dad, look at this bark. Yeah, there's a whole block full of bark chips, Joseph. I'm not going to stop and look at that right now. But, Dad, this is a cool one. No, put it down. A few more steps, you know. Hey, Dad, somebody threw a yogurt cup in here. This is cool. I could use this for a pirate mug. Joseph, throw that back in there. We're not using old yogurt cups for a mug. And he would try to hide it in his jacket or shirt. And keeping the pirate mug. I'm not throwing that back in the bushes. You know, so he's collecting these things. To this day, he goes back. We have an alley behind our house. And there's college kids back there. And they flip beer caps into the alley. And Joseph, to this day, goes out and collects all these things. Like they're Spanish doubloons. And he hides them under his bed till it smells like 10 alcoholics live in his bedroom. I have to go and take these things out and disappear them. But this is Joseph. He goes, I don't know what happened to all the beer caps. There's fairies who live under my bed and take them. I don't know. But this was the struggle we had. He would walk and he would stop at all these things he'd want to look at. And I was always, eventually I'd pick him up and hold him over my shoulder and run and drop him off and get there. Well, one night, we're having dinner, Joseph's sitting at the table, the rest of us, and we're eating dinner, and Joseph says, I started a club today. And we say, oh, really? You started a club? What's your club? He said, oh, it's called a slow club. And he said, I'm the president. I said, oh, is other kids in your club? No, it's just me. You know, this is the moment where my wife looks at me to say, this is for you. And I said, well, what do you do in slow club? And he says, we have two rules. No running and no hurrying. So I say, okay. So we kind of talk about this a little bit. We have dinner, we do bedtime. Next morning, I get up. I'm doing the hustle, getting their shoes on, getting their clothes on, getting the backpacks packed, getting everything ready. We go outside the door, say, no, we got to get there. We got to hurry up and get to the school, run a little bit late. Noah takes off running. I'm getting ready to say, Joseph, come on, we got to go on. Joseph goes, he's walking like this. I say, Joseph, we got to hurry. He goes, Dad, I'm in slow club. I can't run and I can't hurry. And so for the rest of that morning, I'm walking like this. You know, just incredibly constipated. Just, I can't believe this. To walk like this because he's president. And so for the rest of that year, he would ask, anytime people came over to our house or kids or whatever, he would ask him, do you want to join my club? And he'd had us write out his little charter, and nobody could agree to be in the club. Because nobody could honestly promise to follow these two rules. So, the next summer, I'm leading a camp up in Washington, and Joseph's with me, and he wakes up in the morning. He says, Dad, would you like a one-day pass to slow club? I had to think about it. And I finally said, okay, I'll do this. And so takes his colors out, and he makes me a little one-day pass, and I keep this thing. And so we are kind of hanging out for the day, and it's not too bad. And at lunchtime, we're out, we're watching some kids playing Ultimate Frisbee, and they're out in this field, and they're playing, we're watching them. And the lunch bell rings, and it's one of these lunches where, like, they only got so much hot food. You know, it's like one chicken leg per every 2.3 people. And then it's peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, you know, on the... And so as soon as I hear that lunch thing, right, I'd say to Joseph, I say, we got to run. We got to hurry because there's going to be a big line. All these kids are going to be there. Come on, that's the lunch bell. Let's get going. And Joseph says, Dad, you're in slow club now. We don't run. And so we walk like this while all these teenagers are running, all the adult counselors are running, the program people, 85-year-olds in walkers are coming by us. We're just moving like this. And he can see I'm a little bit downhearted, and he says, Dad, look around and you're going to notice stuff that other people didn't see, that they ran by. So we're looking around, and sure enough, we see two jackrabbits. And I say, hey, there's two rabbits. He goes, yeah. He says, now, Dad, the other people didn't see those. Yeah, it's kind of cool. So we walk a little further, and we see these lupin flowers, and we see different butterflies. We see this group of lizards on a rock sunning themselves, and I'm getting kind of excited. And we get and we have lunch, and my wife's there, and my other son's there, and Joseph's like, Dad, tell Mom what you saw. And I'm telling her about all these things, and he's just sitting there. And I realized that Joseph is trying to help me recover something I knew but have lost. You see, we are trained to no longer see the presence of God in the world. We're trained to always focus on the end goal instead of the journey in getting there. We're trained to no longer allow ourselves to fall back and wonder at the night sky, to sit there gazing on the beauty of this world. We're trained to sort of lose it, and we start to go numb. Well, the soul is that place in us that's in constant wonder. Even while we scurry on, living in our minds that are analyzing and criticizing and organizing and anxious, our soul still sits back in awe and wonder. You know, I just was with a group of kids up at a lake, Lake Tahoe, and I told them, I said, you know, when I was coming in tonight, I said, there was a sunset that was just gorgeous, and there's the Sierra Mountains over the lake, and I said, it was purple, and it was beautiful. And these kids kind of sat there, and I had this feeling, I said, have you guys ever seen a sunset before? I mean, like, really sat and watched it? And there was about 50 or 60 teenagers, and they all said, no. And I said, that's the program tonight. I'm taking you out to the edge of the lake. I'm going to want you to sit by yourself and say, God, I just want to be with you. And then I want you to watch the sun go down. Now, what do you think their first response was? How long is this going to take? How long does the sunset last? I said, we're just going to try this. Don't worry. It's not going to be too long. Give me your cell phones and iPods and all the other gadgets. And I staggered them out. And I've done this two or three times where I've had kids do this. And we watched the sun go down, and it's lavender and pinks, and the shoulders of these mountains kind of silhouette against the sky. And these colors start to reflect off the stillness of the lake. And it's just spectacular as the North Star and these other stars start to come out into the sky in that blue that gets darker and darker and finally turns black. And we're sitting there. And every time I do this, this happens. Kids start to cry. They just start to cry. It's so beautiful, they say. It's just so beautiful. Our kids need to recapture that sense of wonder. We need to recapture. That's where our souls thrive and grow and stretch. That's where God lives in us, in that place of wonder.
Oh, we hate to wait, don't we? At the grocery store, at the bank, at the airport. We hate, like me, getting stuck behind a long line of traffic because the lights at the corner of Lima and Coliseum are not working. I go nuts sometimes. You know, the folks down at Disney World, they understand this. They know us very well. And that is why there are never straight lines going to any amusement. You remember what they do? They zig back and forth and back and forth. You don't get to where you're going any sooner, but it gives you the illusion that you're moving. And that way you are not so miserable. Disney says this model is called all lines must be kept moving. And contrast this with the biblical model, be still, slow down, and know that I am God. As Mark Yaconelli suggests, our soul is the patient part of us. And it is only as we slow down and realize that being still is essential to the journey. Stopping and pulling the car over to watch the sunset, to get in touch with that which is beyond us. It is only then that we will authentically be able to wait. Not going 75, but slow. Not shouting, but whispering. Not frantic, but focused. Amen?